Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve! It's grace. It's a beautiful song. But it's a beautiful word. It's just this big, beautiful word. I don't mean like letters and all that. I mean, I didn't realize it's a five-letter, one-syllable word. But the word grace is just big and beautiful and a little bit bewildering, quite frankly. It's the kind of word that honestly changes the atmosphere of a room. If there's tension in a room and someone speaks of grace, suddenly it's like, oh, tension eased. The very songwriter there, Bono, from which we heard from just a moment ago, the great theologian Bono, we heard from him. He penned that song, of course, and he says, grace, she takes the blame, removes the shame, covers the stain. It could be her name. There's something about the word grace that's just so powerful. It's just a big, beautiful, but yet somewhat bewildering word. In fact, I'm not the first person to struggle with the tone of grace. I mean, it's such a good tone word. Before you think I'm crazy, there was a guy, another songwriter actually, named John Newton. He penned a famous lyric, I believe, with a quill, because he's very old. So he was like that. I don't know if people actually did that with their quills, but it seems like they did. Lighten up, people! I know, we had a heavy mood, but we're coming out of it. Come on, here we go. So, pen and quill, John Newton pens this famous lyric. Regardless of your spiritual background, I'm sure you've probably heard this one, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saves a wretch like me. So this week, I was very, very curious about that. So I went to a lot of the people here that worked at Verve, maybe some of the interns and some other of my friends, and I said, hey, you know that song, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound saves a wretch like me? And they were like, yeah, I know it. I was like, what's the sound? And they were like, what? I was like, what's the sound? It says, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. What is that sound? What does grace sound like? And they were like, Google, because that's what we do whenever we're puzzled. We Google, right? And they couldn't find anything. And a couple of people said some great things. Like one person said, I think it's just the sound of forgiveness. Like, you're forgiven. It's like the sound of mercy. And I was like, that's as good an answer as I've got. But there is something about grace. It's just beautiful. The word itself, big and beautiful, but yet somewhat bewildering. Because I could tell you exactly what it means. I could tell you officially the definition would be to receive the unmerited favor of God. Like we deserve something harsh, but we get something good. We get mercy. And that would be cool, but still it doesn't quite get us there. It's like, what exactly is grace? It's very bewildering. Unlike, by the way, its antonym, its antithesis, which is karma. Karma. That's easy. Who doesn't understand karma? I mean, everybody gets karma. I mean, it's just whatever energy you put out gets put back to you. So you put out bad things come back to you. If you put out good things will eventually come back to you. I mean, who doesn't get that? I mean, one thing we also know about karma is it doesn't come with a sweet tone at all. It comes with very harsh tones. I mean, we all know the harsh tones of karma, don't we? Which is things like this. You know, just the word itself, just to say the word karma, for example, to say karma, the K, you can't make a K sound and not sound harsh. Karma, Ku Klux Klan. You follow me? It's harsh. So you can't make that K sound without it sounding harsh, and we know the harsh tones of karma, which are something like this. You're going to pay for what you've done. One good turn deserves another. I'll get you for that. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That is just nasty. I mean, karma. Who doesn't get karma? That's the easiest thing to understand. And we understand its tones are harsh. Some people would say, well, that's bad karma. If you have good karma, it's not harsh. Well, there's no such thing as bad grace. You know? I mean, we understand karma. I mean, no one has to even explain karma to us. It's what we do in our lives. If you're good to me, you're a good person. If you're bad to me, you're a bad person. If you're good to me and then you do something bad, then you were a bad person all along and you had me fooled. Follow? I mean, it's that way from the early stages of our lives. In fact, when I was just a little boy, I knew this principle very well. No one had to teach me karma. I got it. In fact, so I'm going to take you back to a quick story. It takes place about 30-ish years ago, probably a little more. I was just a wee little guy, wee little lad. It's fun to say, wee little lad. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm a little boy, and I grew up in this pretty tough neighborhood. My parents were not very wealthy. My father was enlisted in the Navy. If you know anything about the military, when you're an E3, you're not making a lot of cash. So we don't live in the nicest neighborhood. And so one thing I knew in my neighborhood well was bullies, multiple bullies at times, kids older than me always picking on me, that sort of thing. And one day, I had an ace in the hole for the bullies, and I should tell you that before I go on, which was, of course, my sister. That's right. I said my sister. 3 years my elder, and pretty tough, I have to tell you. She knew how to handle herself, so to speak. And so for me, she was very much a comfort because I was accustomed to getting bullied, and she helped me a lot. In fact, one day I defended three or four guys at the ditch we used to play at. I told you we were poor. We played in a ditch. I'm not kidding. And so I did something to offend them. And so I am running. I'm trying to race to my house before they catch me. I'm trucking down the street, right? And my sister sees me coming, sees three guys chasing after me, and she picks up this tree trunk type of branch thing. I'm not talking about like a little branch. I'm talking about the type of branch that has branches. She picks it up. So I come running by her, and she does this move. And they're all like, well, okay, we don't want any of that. We don't want any trouble with that. And so I'm all like, yeah, you want some of that? Come on, right there. Because I didn't really know how to talk trash for myself. I only knew how to do it to myself. But yeah, you want some of that there. Yeah, that's right. Go home. So anyway, my sister, before you think too little of me, she was pretty tough. In fact, she had a reputation in our neighborhood. She was sort of renowned, a little infamous, had a move, a patented move that everyone knew and had a name for, and it was the slap. The slap. Bam. And what she would do, in a very ninja-like fashion, she found a way to many an enemy to find a way to catch them right on the small of their back, right back here. She would get them, and she would just literally, whap! And I experienced so many people. I saw them as victims of the slap, and this is the response everybody had to the slap. Their knees would buckle. Oh! They'd quiver a little. They'd go to their knees, and they'd finally fall to the ground, and they would just be done. I mean, the slap was that menacing, right? I loved it. I love the slap. I loved it. I used to taunt with it. I used to be like, hey, you want to try? I'll go get the slapper right there. You don't want that. And people, I don't want any trouble with that because, again, I don't really know how to talk trash for myself. So I was like, I loved it. It had worked for me so many times. It had gotten me out of so many jams. My sister was actually quite amazing. She could do ninja-like moves. Her enemy would be in front of her, and she would just be like, that's funny. Like that, and they would go down every time. It was pretty stunning, actually. I love the slap. Until, yeah, it's one of those stories. So suddenly I'm about 12 years old. I'm a little older now. I got a little bit more going for me. I can fend for myself a little bit. And I'm in an altercation with my sister. We're home alone. We're having a little exchange of words, expanding our vocabulary a little bit, if you know what I mean. Just having a shout match. And my sister says something very brazen, like this. She says something like that. I wish you would, because I would kill you. And so again, I'm 12 at this point. I'm a little more able to fend for myself. So I get right in her face. That's good. I learned how to talk trash for myself. I got right in my face. I said, psh, if you think you can, go for it. And then I turned around and started walking away. Don't get ahead of me. Yeah. Free tip. Never turn your back on your enemy. Seriously. So yeah, I'm all, if you think you can, go for it. Turn my back. And of course, you know what happens next. Wah! And I had the same response that I'd seen many people before me have. Oh, quivering, buckling knees, going down. I'm all the way down on the ground. My sister then does this move. It's the only move I can describe as maybe Joe Pesci and My Cousin Vinny. She's over me doing this little move. How you like me now? She's doing the whole Joe Pesci, right? And I'm down on the ground. And listen, have you ever had a moment in your life where something happens to you and unexplainably you get intoxicated with like a fuel, like an energy that can only be associated with rage. I mean, like fury doesn't even do it. It's like rage. And it just sort of overwhelms you. And maybe you start turning green. I don't know when clothes start ripping. You're left with nothing but purple shorts. I don't really know. But it's a Hulkian like anger. I am on the ground, and this is what I'm experiencing. I am so furious. I'm just bent on destruction suddenly. And in that moment, I'm hovered over. My sister's doing the Joe Pesci over top of me. And I give her this look. And something in that look communicated to my sister, I've still got something left. I'm still prepared to fight you. My sister took that quite seriously, and she ran. So I got up and ran after her. She went to the kitchen. I went to the kitchen. She took a left to the dining room. I took a left to the dining room. She went to the doorway. I went to the hallway to the bedrooms. I went to the doorway through the hallway to the bedroom. She took a right at the hallway that led to the bedrooms. I took a right at the hallway that led to the bedroom. Her bedroom was all the way at the far end of that hallway. I am right on her tail. I don't know how she pulled this off to this day, literally, but she managed to go through her bedroom door, shut it, and must have just been like one sweet little and lock. Because when I got to the door, it was like wham, oh, and I'm pounding on the door, and I'm saying, you're going to pay for what you've done. You're going to pay for that. Because I knew karma all too well. You've done something bad to me, and now you're going to pay for it. In that moment, I'm so fuming. I'm so intoxicated with rage. I'm so amped up. Anybody know exactly what I'm talking about? I am amped. I am fueled. I'm just pounding. So finally, I just turn around. I go to the other end of the hallway, and I look back at the door. And I don't think I did this, but it would seem appropriate because I was like fuming and I just start running and I am running full speed. And when I hit that door, I was in this sort of stance right here and knee out, elbows out. That door didn't have a chance. I came through that door with such energy. The door comes flying off the hinges. I mean, pieces and wood shrapnel are flying everywhere. I mean, there's dust, there's debris. I come landing down in my sister's room, and I'm like, oh, and I'm looking around, and I'm like, where is she? And I look over, and she's in the corner, huddled up on her bed, and she looks at me, and this is what she says. Oh, you're the dead one now. Dad is going to kill you. And my dad believed in karma. Have you ever had a moment in your life where for whatever reason, something happened to you and it almost scared you? Like, I didn't even know I was capable of that. I would have swore to people I would never do that. Have you ever had that kind of moment? Have you ever had the kind of moment where you said, I can't believe anybody would behave like that. I can't believe anybody would act like that. And suddenly you act like that and you go, I didn't even know I was capable. Anybody? I mean, maybe your door, my door at that moment was I received this slap and I was angry, but maybe your door is something far different. Maybe your door is, maybe it's, how did I get into this situation? When did my marriage come to this? Maybe it's a transgression and you're like, I swore I would never do anything like that. How has this happened? Maybe it's alcohol. Maybe it's like, when did it get to the point where I couldn't stop drinking these? Maybe quite frankly, it's food. Maybe it's like, when did I get to the point where I couldn't stop eating the box and then I elevated that family style? When did it get to the point where I just would trade everything in for a single moment of pleasure? When did I start doing this? Have you ever had a moment in your life where whatever it was that was fueling you, whatever it was that was pushing you towards an event, toward a moment, suddenly abandoned you and you were left going, uh-oh, this was my moment. I'm standing on the side of the door with my sister looking at me going, you're the dead one now. And I thought she was right. And I'm literally like, oh, I sure hope I don't get what I deserve. That's grace. You see, grace is a big, beautiful, and bewildering concept. And I would suggest you not, you have no idea what it means until you need it. And then when you need it, whatever it is that puts you on the other side of a door, wondering how did it come to this, whatever it is that does that for you, when you get there, you realize, quite frankly, oh my gosh, I hope I get mercy over karma. I mean, who doesn't know that? Right? Because here, let's be honest with ourselves. Everybody loves themselves some karma. until they need grace. Am I right? I mean, who doesn't love karma? Who doesn't love justice and fairness? And if you've wronged me, you know, because quite frankly, I'll be quite honest with you, if you do something bad to me, I want something bad to happen to you. I mean, who doesn't love that? Everybody loves karma until you find yourself on the other side of a door wondering, how did it come to this? And then suddenly you're like, I sure hope there's grace. That's when you know. That's when the big, beautiful, bewildering word of grace starts to make sense in your mind, because you know, I hope there's some kind of mercy out there for me. But we don't live in a very merciful world, though, do we? We sure don't. And so I want to take us to a story in the scriptures that I find to be fascinating. In fact, I talked about this very story about 6 weeks ago-ish from this very spot. And I told, if you were here, I told you that it was a very troubling story for me on my journey to becoming a follower of Jesus. I really stumbled on a couple of things. There were two words in the story that just really tripped me up. I didn't see them as grace words. I associated them with the harsh tones that you would associate with other things. I'll talk about that again in a moment. We'll review it. But lest you think it's the only passage I know anything about, it's really not. But I did promise that one day we'd come back and revisit it, maybe talk more about it. And so we're going to take a few more steps in that direction, and we still won't even be able to cover all the ground tonight, but we'll get a little further. Sound good? So let me give you some backlog. Things you need to know before we look at the passage. In Jesus' day, religion is rampant, obviously, and there are religious leaders, and some of them are called Pharisees. And they're very powerful people. They're very knowledgeable people. They're very quite a bit pious. They love to do things for show. They love to give money, for example, but they love to do it in a way that everybody knows they're doing it. Like, hey, look at me giving my money. And they love to pray in public and say, look how holy I am praying in public. And Jesus has very harsh words for them. He says things like, hey, people who do that, you've received your reward in full, because it's just a show for you. They were very concerned. They're very concerned about the outward appearance and not so concerned about the inside. They really weren't concerned about transformation inside. They were concerned about how do you appear to be to people. And they were quite religious, and they were quite educated, and they were quite pious in their belief. There was another group called Sadducees who were just like Pharisees in a lot of ways. They were very, very high up on the totem pole of religion. They were the religious leaders. But they were very, very wealthy. I mean, they were from the wealthiest of backgrounds. They would be like your televangelists. They just made a lot of money, and they found ways to capitalize on the God thing and make more money. So you had these two groups, Pharisees, Sadducees. And often what they would do is they would take the elite of these two groups and they would put them into a little council, a ruling council, a council that would make decisions. And in different towns, they would have these things called Sanhedrins. And so in every town, they had a Sanhedrin normally of about 23 people. But in Jesus' area, which is a hotbed of Holy Landish thing, that's where you get the Holy Land, Jerusalem, there is a great council where only the elite of the elite of the elite of the religious leaders could sit on this council. There were 71 of them, 70 Pharisees and Sadducees, and then the high priest. It was called the Great Sanhedrin. And this council made decisions on what should happen to people when they did something wrong. They were the karma council. They were like, you've done something wrong, we sit and decide what now becomes of you. So this is who they are. They make the decision. They are the Great Sanhedrin. There's a member of this group, the Great Sanhedrin. He's a Pharisee. His name is Nicodemus. And he comes to visit Jesus in the middle of the night. In the cover of dark, he seeks him out. Good chance that he didn't want to be seen with Jesus, because there was friction between Jesus and the religious leaders, because Jesus didn't come to start a religion. He came to show people the way to God. So there's a great friction between them. So maybe he doesn't want to be seen with Jesus in the daylight, because he's afraid he'll get spotted by his cohorts and they'll be like, what are you doing hanging out with Jesus? For whatever reason, but he's with Jesus at night. So it's Nicodemus with Jesus at night, which gives us, of course, the first ever episode of Nick at Night. Right? Had to be said. Had to be said. Don't hate on me. Had to be done. All right. So now that you have the backlog, let's take a look. John chapter 3, 1 through 9, we'll start. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a member of the Jewish ruling council. He came to Jesus at night and said, Rabbi, we know you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you are doing if God were not with him. And Jesus, in reply, Jesus declared, I tell you the truth, no one can see the kingdom of God unless he's born again. How can a man be born when he is old? Nicodemus asked. Surely he cannot enter a second time into his mother's womb to be born. Again, disturbing mental imagery. Don't go there. Just don't. Okay. Jesus answered, I tell you the truth, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless he is born of water and the Spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, but the Spirit gives birth to spirit. You should not be surprised at me saying you must be born again. The wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. How can this be? Nicodemus asked. How can this be? Those two words planted right in the middle of that little passage are the two words that gave me the most trouble, born again. Because I viewed them as very much in my cultural lens of religious term, hypocrisy, judgment, political term. And I was like, oh, I want nothing to do with the born agains. What I didn't realize at the time, and what you may not be realizing what's happening here, is Nicodemus is coming as a religious leader, as a person who's on the karma council, you might say, a person who understands nothing but eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, and making sure justice and fairness and religion is done right, and people are seen and judged by their outer appearance, not by what's going on inside of them. And he's visiting Jesus at night, and for the first time in the history of man that I know of, grace and karma come into a collision course. You have a man coming to see Jesus in the middle of the night who's saying, What are you talking about? And Jesus is introducing an idea. Forget what you know about born again. He's introducing an idea of second life, another chance. He's introducing the concept that says, when you find yourself on the other side of that door, whatever that door is for you, be it alcohol, be it drugs, whatever it is, sexual immorality, whatever it is, greed, whatever the case, you know, whatever, if it's just you got hit and you want to hit back, whatever the case is, when you find yourself on the other side of that door going, how did my life come to this? I sure hope I don't get what I deserve. Please tell me there's mercy. Jesus is saying, there is. You could be born again. You could start again. What could be more beautiful than the idea of starting again? And you have karma and grace on collision. And to Nicodemus, it sounds very strange. I mean, for us, it's hard enough to grasp grace. Like, I think Bono actually said it very well. It's very hard for us to grasp grace. We understand atonement. We understand judgment, fairness, all those things. But grace? The idea that you be wronged and you forgive? You would choose to forgive? It's mind-blowing stuff. And to Nicodemus, it's unheard of. It's hard enough for us, but this is he's like, what are you talking about? What is this that you're saying to me? Jesus will go on to say to him, if you can't understand some earthly concepts that I'm laying out to you, how are you going to understand heavenly things? And he gives an account saying, I come from the heavens. I'm bringing you a God idea. That's why it's rattling your ears. Let me ask you this. We've already established, and are you pretty much with me that everybody understands karma? Are you with me? Who doesn't get karma, right? Let me ask you this. Could that be a God idea? Really? I mean, dare I say this? He's not much of a God if he can't blow our minds. Do you follow me? I mean, you really reason this out in your head. Grace is a mind-blowing concept. It's mind-blowing to even conceive of it. It's even more mind-blowing to be able to pull it off. And Jesus is the one who says, not only is it real, I am going to do it. I'm going to prove it. I'm going to ransom my life for you so that when you find yourself on the other side of a door wondering how did it come to this, you know there is mercy. There is one who can help you. There is one that saves. There is one who can pull you out of it. And in our own way, we are incapable of giving this type of thing. But with the help of God, who is the author of it, our lives can start to be lives of grace, giving. But Jesus says, you must recognize it and be born of the Spirit. Anyone born of the flesh knows karma. But to understand grace, you must be born of the Spirit. It's a God idea. And shouldn't God blow our minds? Shouldn't God really stretch us? At the heart of every world religion in the world is karma. I don't buy it. That's what we do with everybody. It's a man-made idea. You treat me bad, you're bad. You treat me good, you're good. Who can't conceive that? If God doesn't blow my mind, then he's not much of a God. But grace does just that. Jesus will go on to say, in the most famous verse probably in all of Christendom, if you have never heard, I'm sure you've heard it. If you haven't heard it, you've seen it written, John 3:16, where the guy with the big funny wig with all the colors and he holds it up behind the goalposts or behind the basketball net. No one? Really? Watch for him. He's there. He's got a big sign, John 3:16. All right, so verse 16, picking it up. For God so loved the world, Jesus says, that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already because he has not believed in the name of God's one and only son. This is the verdict. So we have a verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by truth comes into the light, so that it may be seen plainly that what he has done has been done through God. When does Nicodemus come to Jesus? At night, in the cover of dark. So perhaps Nicodemus has come to Jesus at night because he doesn't want to be seen by his cohorts. He doesn't want to risk the tension of having to explain why he came to see Jesus. But there's that one line that Jesus throws in. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. And I can't say with great certainty, but I can speculate with the best of them. What if Nicodemus is out there at night because he's already realized? Maybe he's already been on the other side of the door. Maybe he's already done something where he realized, oh my gosh, how did it come to this? And if it's just our system that we've created here, this whole like ruling council, this whole Sanhedrin thing, if I had to stand before our own Sanhedrin, I am screwed. So I sure hope that there is mercy. I mean, maybe he's already committed a deed. Maybe he realizes, man, our system has huge flaws because no one can live up to it. I mean, they had so many rules. No one. I mean, with all the rules they had, you were screwed some way or another. And maybe he realizes, there's no one who could live up to this. I can't live up to this. I can't bear the weight of this. And so I'm here looking at Jesus in the middle of night thinking, I sure hope I don't get what I deserve. Maybe. Maybe. I'd say there's a pretty good chance because actually later in the scriptures, Nicodemus not only shows himself to be a follower of Jesus, not only not at night, but right in the cover of day when Jesus is crucified on the cross, Nicodemus is there to help wrap his body and prepare it for burial right in the sight of everyone. So maybe you realize, man, we need grace. That's what we need. We don't have a chance without it. It's actually an interesting thing that Jesus says, this famous verse that we have in Christianity, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son that whoever believes in him would not perish, but have eternal life. There's a couple key things there. You notice Jesus says, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son that whoever believes in him. You know, God, it says in the Bible that God is not willing that anyone would perish. That God is everyone. It doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter what the outer shell looks like. God is interested on who you are. He's interested in who you are and interested in transforming your life, whoever. But here's the more fascinating statement, actually. It's the next sentence that comes after it. Jesus says, God did not. He tells us why God sent his son, and then he tells us why he didn't. God did not send his son to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. It's interesting that he says flat out, God did not send his son to condemn the world, but the world might be saved. But yet so many Christians, so many religious Christians mainly, who are worried about the outer appearance and not the inside transformation, think that it's their job to condemn the world. Now listen, hear me on this, seriously. I believe Jesus is coming again. He says it, I believe it. I think if he could beat death, he could probably come again. So I believe he's coming again. And I believe he's coming to judge. I believe there will be judgment, and I thank God for that. I thank God that sometime in the history of this world, things will be made right, and the injustices that we suffer at the hands of will be made right, and all things will be made anew, and all things will be brought into order that are out of order, because this world is a harsh place. So I thank God for that. I also thank God that in the meantime right now, God has invited me into a place in his kingdom so I could go out into this world and actually make a difference in it right now. That I don't have to wait for that day to come. I can actually start making that happen right now. That's a good thing. And I thank God. I thank God for it. But Jesus says that when he came, and that day will come for judgment, but he came in his first coming, not to condemn, but to save. And it's interesting, and I'm going to pick a little bit on the religion of Christianity here for a moment, because I don't believe in it. I don't believe that Jesus came to start a religion. I think he came to bring people to God. And I think he's saying to Nicodemus, you view the outer shell, you worry about the outer shell, but I'm worried about what goes on the inside, the spirit. You must be born of the flesh, but you must be born of spirit. And I'm interested in transformation of the spirit. Because spirit is who you are. You just have a body. You're not a body who has a spirit. That's who you are. And Jesus wants to transform it. And it's fascinating how so many Christians have gotten into the realm of just judging the outer appearance. And in a lot of ways, if I could dare say this, a lot of Christianity today looks more like the Pharisees and the Sadducees than it does like the true followers of Jesus. Fair? And that's very fascinating to me. So let me tell you a quick story to close up. It's a little fun fact. You guys know dandelions? You know what a dandelion is, right? It's a weed. You know what I'm talking about? It's a weed. It's a terrible, terrible weed. It's a weed that you cannot get rid of, no matter what you do, I promise you. We spend, in our culture, all kinds of money trying to put certain things down on our lawn to try to rid ourselves of dandelion. If you ever try to pull a dandelion, you know it's got the nastiest root system in the world. It's the hardest thing to uproot. Anybody know what I'm talking about? It is the hardest thing to uproot, and it tears off, and you're like, oh, drats, it's coming back. And so it's very hard, and it's got those nasty little leaves, which where it bears its name, Tooth of the Lion, which is Tooth of the Lion, it's French, in case you didn't recognize it. And so anyway, little leaves, Tooth of the Lion, dandelion. It's a weed that's very, very hard to get rid of. We spend all kinds of money trying to rid ourselves of this weed. We go through all time and effort to try to get rid of this weed and eradicate in the name of the perfectly manicured American lawn. We want to get rid of the weed, the dandelion. Quick fun fact. Dandelions are not indigenous to North America. Did you get that? You know what that means, right? They're not natural here. They're not supposed to be here. They were never intended to be here in the first place. If you're like me and you spent money trying to get rid of them or you tried to uproot them, you're asking the same question I ask. Who is responsible for this? Who would bring this horror on us? Who would bring the dandelion to North America if it wasn't supposed to be here? It was the American colonists. Yeah. That's crazy if you really reason this out. You've got a group of people who are trailblazers. I mean, they're forging new paths. I mean, your life is so bad in your country. You're whatever it is, wherever you are, you're under such religious oppression, under such tyranny or whatever, that you're willing to leave everything behind and risk crossing an ocean that you know very little about on a big boat with a lot of people where people are dying of plagues before they even get there. Some people don't even show up. Where you've heard there's colonies over there that just got lost. We don't even know what happened to them to this day. And you're willing to carve a path and you bring a dandelion? Seriously? I mean, what does that look like? What does that look like when you're packing? You know, you're packing the make the trip overseas, blazing a trail, carving a path, all that good stuff, and you're thinking it out, and you're reasoning it out, and you're like, I am a colonist. I should probably bring an axe. Because if I don't bring an axe, I will not have an axe when I get to the other side. And if I don't have an axe, I can't chop down trees and build log cabins, and that's what we colonists do, right? Follow me? So I should bring an axe. I should probably bring a weapon. I should bring a weapon because I've heard there's some hostility over there and we don't know what's waiting for us on the other side. And if I don't bring a weapon, I won't have a weapon when we get there and then I could be in trouble. There could be hostility. And I might not be able to protect my family. I should bring a weapon. So I should bring my axe and I should bring a weapon. I should bring plenty of garments. I've heard the weather is unpredictable. I heard that there's harsh winters. We don't really know what we're going to face. I should make sure we have plenty of garments. So I should bring an axe, and I should bring a weapon, and I should bring some garments. I should get all that together. There's very limited space on the boat, mind you. We don't have a lot of room. So we should definitely bring an axe, weapon, garments. What else should we bring? Oh, yeah, okay, all right. So that's it. Axe, weapon, garments. Okay, honey, you got the kids. Let's go. Okay, oh, wait, don't forget the weed. Okay, that's funny, people. Come on, that's funny. Don't forget the weed. Wow. That was funny. I worked very hard on it. Yeah, so anyway. So seriously, though, you bring a dandelion, you have limited space, and you bring a dandelion, you bring a weed with you? It doesn't make any sense. Unless you know that this thing that we consider a weed, this thing that we think should be eradicated in order for us to have our perfectly manicured American lawn, they considered so valuable. They thought it was a necessary ingredient to their survival in the new world. They thought, we can't go without that. This thing that now we just view as worthless and just whatever, you know, just we need to eradicate it, they considered a necessary ingredient for the survival. And there were several reasons for that, actually. The flower itself could be used for dyeing garments and for producing wine. The leaves, those horrible leaves, they actually have more nutritional value than both spinach and broccoli. So today, if you go into a really nice restaurant, you can get a dandelion salad. They're very nutritious. I wouldn't eat it, but it's very nutritious. And then, of course, the stem and root system can be used for medicinal purposes and even turned into a coffee or tea-like drink without the ill effects of caffeine. I know what you're thinking, ill effects? I love the effects. But that's what they saw value in. So imagine for a second there's a group of people that are trailblazers, forging a new path, making a new way, that have something that they consider such high value, and just a few generations later, people of the same lineage, same heritage, think it's worthless and needs to be gotten rid of in order for they can have a perfectly manicured American landscape that looks good. Can you imagine such a thing? That's unheard of, isn't it? Could that be the church? Could that be the church? Could it be that Jesus and his immediate followers saw certain groups of people as so highly valuable to the movement of the kingdom, and yet within just a few generations, maybe the church turned that into, no, that's a weed. And could it be, at the risk of sounding cliche and a little corny, could it be that where other people saw weeds, Jesus saw a flower full of potential and thought grace makes beauty out of ugly things? Could it be? You know, there's a scene in Jesus' life where a prostitute barges in. Jesus is having dinner with a group of Pharisees, and a prostitute barges in and throws herself at Jesus' feet. And it's like every Pharisee in the room goes, man, that's a weed that needs to be eradicated in order that we can have the perfectly manicured religious experience. And Jesus says, no, that's not a weed at all. That's a flower full of amazing potential and a necessary ingredient to the survival of my movement, the kingdom. Because Jesus knows this, which we often don't know, is that you don't understand grace and you're not willing to give it until you've been on the other side of the door and you need it. And Jesus is basically saying to these religious people, you do-gooders who think you have it all together, I'm not even here for you because you think you've already got it all together. You have no concept of what I'm talking about, grace. You don't know grace until you've been on the other side of that door and you're like, I sure hope I don't get what I deserve. And Jesus knows when you find people like that and you show them that there is grace, they will turn their lives around and they will give grace and they will be like, everybody has to know about this. Could it be that the church, the very vessel, the very body of Jesus, has turned into just yet another religion that views people in the way they perform and sees weeds that need to be eradicated for the sake of the perfectly manicured religious experience instead of seeing flowers full of potential because grace makes beauty out of ugly things? I want to pray. And then we're going to do another tune, and we're going to give you an opportunity to partake in communion, which in and of itself is a beautiful symbol of grace, because it's kind of a freaky thing when you really think it out. It represents body and blood broken and shed for us. And yet it is one of the most beautiful things that we can participate in, to remember that Jesus gave everything that we could have everything. So that when we were on the other side of that door, we're crying out for mercy, that we would know mercy was there. So I'm going to pray, and we'll play, and then you can just partake at your leisure. So let's do that. Jesus, we're really just grateful for who you are and what you've done. Grateful that grace is possible, that mercy is real. And God, for those of us who have been on the other side of that door, pleading for mercy, God, I just pray a great prayer of thanks that it's there. And God, you giving Jesus is the most generous act in human history. May we live generous lives in response. We pray all in the name of Jesus. Amen.